Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 541. That was a big stammer at the start there. Welcome in. If you knew, I've got a stutter, but it's fine. It's not a big deal. it probably won't come up a lot. I'm joined this week by Josh Weller. Now, this episode was meant to come out 2 weeks ago, but we shuffled some things around, which means I've been excited for you to hear and laugh at this for ages, because this conversation just put a big smile on my face, like, for the rest of that week. Josh Weller has been on before, but in different guises. So I first met Josh as a musician in, like, the 2007, maybe? And when Josh came on the podcast last, I think he was just wrapping up his punk band, The Kenneths, and he'd just started. He'd done his first ever stand-up gig. Now, all these years on, post-pandemic, he's a wonderfully successful stand-up. And I went to see his Edinburgh Fringe show this year, and it was so fucking good. We talk about all of that, though, so we'll get into that. We also talk about the struggles of making money in the creative arts. And this is where I'll mention speechdevelopmentrecords.com, which is my record label and web store where you can go and support by buying merch, decking yourself out in some cool shit. And then, yeah, you also support the podcast. So that's kind of cool. You can also donate at patreon.com/ScroobiusPip. So if you've been listening for a while and you're like, I get this every week for free and I enjoy it. There's been at least one episode every week for over 9 years. For over 9 years. An episode a week completely free. You know what? I'd like to give that Pip a dollar or two to go to Pip, to go to Buddy Peace, to go to Jared, you know, all the people who work tirelessly behind the scenes. Yeah, I'm going to go to patreon.com/ScroobiusPip and throw some money at that hairy bastard. You can also head to twitch.tv/ScroobiusPip. Yo, where? In fact, this ties into the label. I said I'd tell you about this last week. So, many of you will know that on Black Friday, I closed the web store because Black Friday is a weird little retail holiday, isn't it? A lot of people say, oh, it's because you're just being tight and you don't want to give discounts. At the start of the cost of living crisis, we discounted everything by, I think it's 27%, which was the average increase in bills. So we've had everything that we can afford to discount already discounted all that time. So it's not that. It's purely, I feel, that we often spend these times spending money on things that we don't need. So instead, the web store is closed. There will be a donation link to donate to Shelter, who I've fundraised for the last two Black Fridays and who need it more than ever now with our government fucking talking shit about lifestyle choices. But Friday afternoon, evening, I've not decided a definite time. I think it'll be 5 p.m. I'm going to be doing a charity bike ride on Twitch. So I've got my exercise bike. I'm going to be on that. I'm going to do a marathon, which is 42 kilometers. There'll be donation links. There'll be chat interaction. I'll be sweating like an idiot for however long it takes. All the money will be going to Shelter. So come along and get involved in that. Yeah, that's all I've got to tell you about that, but that's going to be a laugh. Let's get on with the podcast, right? Josh Weller, as I've said, is one of my favourite people and just one of the funniest guys. He's always been one of the funniest guys I know. I get a bit emotional, I think, at the end and kind of give a bit of a, I'm so happy that the rest of the world is now getting to see the Josh that I've always known. It's cringy as fuck, but I meant it. Deep in my heart, I meant it. So this is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 541 with Josh Weller. It's easier. We can relax. I'm here today with Josh Weller. How are you, Josh?
I'm good, man. How are you? Nice to see you.
I'm good. I've been really genuinely looking forward to this chat since we organised it, which was only a couple of days ago, so it's not like you've taken over my whole week, but it feels like we've not caught up in ages. But because I am such a fan of so much of the content that you create, and I know content and creation are bad words these days, they're kind of cringy, but I feel like I catch up with you all the time, but it's purely passively. I'm just enjoying your creations, then getting on with my day.
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? I see friends all the time and I'm like, I don't need to see you. I know exactly what you've been doing.
Yeah.
Podcasts. Yeah, you've gone on tour, media. You've got a podcast, you know, you're unhappy inside and you need attention, so.
It's quite straightforward. Well, before we get into it, like, how are you? How's your week been? Like, what's been going on? What's your world at the moment?
I'm getting back into just doing clubs every night for stand-up. I did the Edinburgh Festival and now it's sort of back to auditions for TVs and movies and things like that. And then doing, just gigging every night. So I've done, what day is it today? Friday. I think I've done 7 shows already this week. So I'm pretty ready for the weekend.
How do you find auditions and acting? Because you're someone that quite easily sees the ridiculousness in things, and having acting as my main thing, I know there's a lot of ridiculousness, so I genuinely wonder sometimes if that makes it harder for you, because you're having to go, oh, this is all dumb, because you were in The Witcher, right? Is it The Witcher?
Yeah. I mean, I don't have any acting. I briefly saw a really good acting coach, a guy called Lee Knight, but that was only when I got The Witcher. So I auditioned for it and I was doing a bunch of auditions. I actually was in a sitcom, but they when it went to series, they wrote me out. So, and after that, I was sort of, you know, I kept plugging away and I got this role and it was a small role. I think I'm in 3 episodes of it or something like that. And firstly, I didn't watch The Witcher. And then I got the part and was like, all right, I should probably watch.
Oh, that's one of the things with getting a role like that. The bonus is it's a huge series. It's established. It's a certain number of series in. The negative is if your mates want to watch it, they've got like 3 series to catch up on first. So that's why I've not seen you in it, Josh. I think The Witcher is my kind of thing. I just didn't catch it at the time. But it's one of those weird things, isn't it? You've got an established audience there, but your mates might not go, okay, oh, so I've got how many episodes to catch up on
exactly,
before I get to your 3 scenes?
My mum was like, I turned it on and you're not in it. I was like, yeah, I'm not in the first episodes. And then she was like, there's a lot of boobs in it. I was like, yes.
I'm not The Witcher.
Yeah. And it's funny doing auditions. I kind of just, it's actually something that I really am enjoying, you know, I wouldn't call myself an actor, but I'm really enjoying acting in things as a comedian. Yeah. And I've just done another show, which I don't know if I can say what it is, but
it's all good.
But I got to act with Ewan McGregor very briefly, which was mental. And when you do the auditions, it is sometimes you are looking at it going, okay, right, what would an astronaut think in this situation? And you're like, I don't know.
You see, I'm kind of glad to hear the positivity here because I adore it. I love auditions. I love being on set. I love all of it, but I love I'm aware of the ridiculousness of it all, but I enjoy it. But I worried at points that you're going to get an audition through and go, ah, for fuck's sake, this is so dumb. This is so stupid. Cause I know how your brain or how good you are at breaking things down and analyzing. And at its core, it is dumb, but that's kind of what I love about it. And I'm glad that you seem to be enjoying that too.
Yeah, I think Jerry Seinfeld said it was just dress up, isn't it? It's when you're playing dress up. And it is that, but it's such a silly challenge to. And I think one thing I've learned is that actors or people who work in TV are really impressed that you're a stand up. Whereas I don't think that that's makes you a better actor. But now the more I've thought about it, the more I think, oh, yeah, actually, if you're on your toes, you know, 7 nights a week in a comedy club. It kind of makes you react a little bit quicker in the moment, which maybe makes you a better actor.
All of the live performance stuff, I remember talking to Brett Goldstein and he was saying how stupid I was for wanting to be an actor. Because he's like, no, all of us actors want to be musicians. You're doing it the wrong way. You're stopping the bit that we want to get to do the bit that we're all sick of. And I think there are certain things there. And again, it's about that, isn't it? I always remember I got my early acting gigs with no training. But again, I'd been encouraged because people were like, well, you perform every night. You've spent all this time on stage. You've done the music videos. And like the simple thing that Simon Pegg said to me, I'm sure it was, I always accredit it to Simon Pegg. I'm probably wrong, but he said that, you know, when you're doing that angry song, you know, you're not really angry. And when you're doing that sad song, you know, you're not really sad, but you're performing it every night. And, you know, it's not the full range of acting, but it's elements there. And then I did the same as kind of what you've said. For me, it was after a few roles, I did some really great acting classes because I'm like, right, I don't want to lose what I've got naturally or the rawness of what I've learned from performance in different areas. But I also don't want to just go, oh, I'll just bowl in and do it.
Yeah.
It'll be fine. I'll just figure it out.
I wish I had Brett Goldstein and Simon Pegg give me acting advice. I think that would help quite a lot.
Mate, I almost dropped the other one. When you were saying that it's dress up, one of the first people I worked with was Tom Hardy. And he's the person who recommended the acting coach I went to and all this stuff. But he refers to it as face pulling. He says he's a face puller, but he gets paid to go and pull faces. And he's just really good at picking the right faces to pull. And I love that. I love things like that. I always remember hearing a podcast as well with Andrew Scott, or seeing an interview maybe with Andrew Scott. And he said, plays are called plays for a reason because they're meant to be up there, their play. And he said, a lot of people take it all too seriously and you have to go and enjoy yourself and mess about. And there's a beauty in that.
My acting coach would get me to do my stand-up, and then when he'd click his fingers, I had to go into the lines. So it's just as a way of like naturalizing. But then that adds a whole other fear. You're like, well, now I'm just bombing in front of one person doing my... I'm just doing stand-up in front of one guy. And he was very kind, like kind of smiling and laughing. But, you know, that's a whole other stressful situation. So as soon as it got to the lines, I was like, oh, thank God, I don't have to keep talking about dick jokes and fart jokes now in front of this acting coach.
That's fucking great on every level though, right? Because you're excited, like all the nerves are gone from doing the actual lines, because you're like, just let me stop doing this fucking one-man gig, this gig to a one-man audience. Were you ever someone to play your music to people face-to-face? Because I'm not going to name any names here, but I've been in a room with numerous musicians who've been like, here, check out this new track, or check out these new tracks. And I sat there in their studio, just like, okie doke. Like, I'm no good. I don't know. I've always been bad at feedback on music anyway. Like, Sage Francis and B. Dolan, the two people I always use an example, who stopped sending stuff to me for feedback. Because my response, I'd listen to everything, every second of it, then go back going, yeah, man, that sounds great. And it's like, right, that's not what we're here for. That's not what we're hitting you up for.
When I was a musician, I went to a big label or something. And they put my demo on, and it was one of the only times that I had to listen to my own music and watch someone listening to it. He was doing keepy uppies the whole time with a football. This like big label guy was like in the office doing these keepy uppies. And then it got to the chorus of my song and he just went, yes. And I went, oh, wow, it's a good chorus. And then he just went, 35 keepy uppies.
I need context. Which era of Josh Weller was this?
Was this
solo artist or punk rock. So tweed. Again, that's even more amusing to think of this adorable, nice pop singer-songwriter stuff, and he's doing keepy uppies.
It was, that was during the, I used to wear... When I first moved to London, I just thought, I was like, you have to have an image. You have to have like a, you know, you have to stand out from the crowd. And someone told me the story that Madonna used to go to parties in her pajamas. So everyone would go, who's the girl in the pajamas? And it would kind of get her name out. And I sort of naively, what Madonna had is that she was also Madonna. So she had she had the skill set and the talent of Madonna. And I think one of the things I did when I moved to London, I wore like tweed jodhpurs and a tweed jacket and a bow tie, and my hair went up like, oh, probably like a foot high with full of like hairspray.
I've got a couple of beautiful pictures of us together in that era.
Yeah, because you used to have a night at Pure Groove Records, didn't you? I was thinking about where we met, and it was such an honor when you asked me to do your, this was 2009 probably?
Yeah.
And it was such an honor to do your gig.
It's funny what you're saying there about how ludicrous an idea it was, that it works though. Because I had the same. I'd always wear a suit and I had a big beard because I knew that on a long night of poetry people, again, you do. There is a point of you've got to have some material as well, but it makes you easy to reference. So people would be, oh, the one, the big guy with the big beard. And that was, you know, at that point, beards hadn't come into fashion or anything. So it was a kind of, that kind of Madonna in pyjamas thing is really handy because it makes you stand out, particularly if you're an acoustic singer-songwriter. I mean, there's a lot of them. How do you differentiate or define which one it was? If you were the one in tweed with a bow tie with huge hair, you know,
were you pissed off when beards came in? Did it annoy you when beards came into fashion?
I mean, I'm not sure which part of this speaks to my ego more. It annoyed me a bit, but more so, I thought, I did that. Because the Guardian did, when hipsters became a thing, the Guardian did a breakdown of what a hipster is. It was either the Guardian or the Independent of what a hipster is. And on their breakdown, they had beards inspired by poet rapper Scroobius Pip. So the Guardian literally credited me with bringing beards into fashion. So there was a small part of me that briefly thought, obviously I'm not solely responsible, but did kind of think, I played my part though.
Someone told me back in the day that Jedward's stylist stole my haircut. And I recounted that to someone recently and they just went, is that a good thing that that's your legacy? Are you proud of that?
What
that
a legacy.
You inspired the Jedward haircut. But it was an interesting time to be a musician in London. I don't know if it's the same now. I don't think there's a scene in the same way. I'm not in it anymore, but I don't know if there's a circuit in the way that, and I'm also not involved with new bands, but I don't know if there's places that people go and play now. Like, whereas when we started, it was like, I would see you probably every week. Just we'd be on a lineup somewhere together.
It's what I loved about that scene though, is it didn't make any sense. Yeah. It was just people that happened to be. Like, it was me, you, like Kate Nash, Jack Pignatte, Adele, Paloma, all these people. There wasn't really a link between what all of us were doing, but we just happened to all be there. And that's what I loved about that, because I've talked in the past how I was never really embraced by any of the rap scenes, really. A little bit of indie rap in America kind of all got on board with me at one point. But thinking back to that scene, it's fascinating because, again, there's no logic. It genuinely is. There's so much chance involved. It must be that we happened to be doing the same open spots, or someone was at one gig and booked us for another. Because, we'd see each other all the time, but what we were making had nothing particularly in common.
No, absolutely. And it was quite an interesting period for music, just in regard to, people complain now about record labels that going on TikTok, and they're like, that's how they find hits now. Isn't that stupid? But it was the same with us, but it was MySpace. It was
100%.
Every generation has a different medium that's sort of judged for how people get their names out. You know, if it was in the 80s and be it like cassette tapes or, you know, gig circuits and whatnot. And now I don't really think it's any different. I just think that maybe the attention span is a little shorter, but you know, if you can write a 15 second clip and have that become a hit record, that's quite a feat in itself. If you put that on TikTok and it goes, you know, and that's something that gets you noticed, I don't really have a problem with that. But I think that it was much more about getting your stripes as a live performer when we met, I think, less about songwriting, which maybe was an oversight on my part. Because I, you know, if I'd have spent more time writing songs rather than spraying my hair up to foot high and going to bow tie shops.
I think you've nailed one of the connections there, though, that did tie that scene together, was we were all people who were getting some level of hype on MySpace, but wanted to go out and perform to get those stripes and earn it. So it wasn't just I know there were bands that blew up on MySpace and never really did much else, because they were just like, oh, everyone loves it, I'm huge. But when they would then get a big festival slot, they were dog shit live. Like, they couldn't do anything. But the beauty of that was all of us were like, oh shit, there's people who want to hear us. Cool. I'm going to go and play every night and meet those people and turn that into real life, you know, fan base and interactions and moments rather than just looking at your listener count on your MySpace music player and stuff like that.
Yeah, and it was all about getting on the MySpace homepage. And I just did, my Edinburgh show was about my sort of failed music career, about trying to be a pop star. And I sort of went back and, you know, had to delve through everything to write the show. And one of the bits I cut from the show was that one of the main things that got me like big label exposure was being on the MySpace homepage. Yeah. And normally when you're on the MySpace homepage, you're on there for like 2 days, 3 days was their kind of rule. And I was on there for 2 weeks, which made the record industry go, wow, he must be really good if MySpace have left him up on the homepage for 2 weeks. But what it was that everyone at MySpace put me on the homepage and then on the like Tuesday went to Glastonbury and got like ketted off their face, went to the festival, watched the Klaxons, came back, had a come down. And then by the time they took me off, it had been about 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And everyone kind of thought, they were like, oh, this guy must be good. But no, it was just everyone was who put me up there went and got spanked and then had a hangover.
It fits perfectly as well though, because everything that you were saying about focusing on maybe style over substance at that point, that's what we remember MySpace for. It's all about the different haircuts and photos that we had in that period. So of course you were on the front for 2 weeks.
I went to that. I remember going to their office once and they had like a jam room. Everyone in the office was about 12 as well, which in retrospect, I walked in there and everyone was 25 and I was like, wow, look at these grown-ups. And there was, everyone was sort of on bean bags and they had a whole room that they were like, this is just in case anyone wants to play music. And then all the food was like bought in every meal of the day. And I just remember going in going like, there is no way this business model is going to work. There is no way that this can survive as the way that it would. No one had a clue what they were doing. People were literally, it was a bit like the Chris Morris, that Nathan Barley show from like 15 years ago. It was literally that, just people just watching the YouTube video of the chimpanzee smelling its ass. And like, and they were all on 60 grand a year. It was insane. It was such a mad boom of social media. It was crazy.
I'd kind of take it back over what we've got now. I'd kind of take back the ignorant idiots kind of just, you know, burn bright and burn out than the fucking dumpster fire that we've got on a lot of social media these days. But I mean, a lot of that are things I want to talk about, but I guess we should fill in some gaps because last time you were on was 2018.
Wow.
Blimey. And a lot has happened since then, because on that episode, you revealed that you'd done your first stand-up gig. Mm. Like the night before or something. And it was the first time you'd talked about moving into stand-up. I think it's something you'd been working on quietly for a while, but it was the first time you almost held yourself accountable and put it on record that you're a comedian now. And it's gone pretty fucking well.
It's been mad. Yeah, I don't think I gigged again. I think I properly started like 2019 is sort of when I consider the start of it. But yeah, I do remember that first gig. I went to Shepherd's Bush and I was so proud of myself. I turned up at the pub, ordered an alcohol-free beer, and I still smoked. I had a cigarette and I was just stood outside the pub and was like, I can't believe I've made this transition from music and I've quit that. And a bunch of people told me not to do stand-up and I was like, I'm going to do it. And I was really happy with myself. I took a sip of the beer and then I realized I was in the wrong pub. So then I had to run across Shepherd's Bush to the right pub and then I just ate my balls, which I continued to do for probably 6 shows a week for a year. You just bomb every night, do an open mic and they're bringer shows and you have to bring someone with you to so that you can get stage time. They won't let you on unless you bring someone. Mm-hmm. So I burnt a lot of friendships doing that. But yeah, it's been like everything I sort of wanted to, everything you dream about happening, you know, I mean, there's a long way to go and to get to where I want to get to, there's still a lot that I want to accomplish, but everything you want to happen when you want to be, when I wanted to be a musician or when you want to be in entertainment or whatever, is that dream of like everything kind of falling into place and like, you know, some cigar chomping record label guy coming to the gig and being like, you're going to be a star, kid. And then before you know it, you know, you're getting your toes licked and you're on a helicopter.
Yeah.
Like that stuff. It was always a struggle in music. Like I couldn't get a record deal. I signed to one in France eventually because that was the only territory that would sign me, and then couldn't get an agent, couldn't get all that stuff. Whereas comedy, everything's kind of just been, I got very lucky very early and I got signed very quickly, and they've been really good and patient and allowing me to work and getting me work and kind of, you know, really padding the ground for me to make. I mean, content I like making it, but I do. Instagram's sort of like an interactive business card. It's sort of how you find a fan base, and going back to, you know, TikTok and MySpace, it's just another way to engage people and try and see a return of investment on ticket sales and stuff like that.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to talk about, because I'm glad you brought up TikTok earlier in music, because in the music industry now, I know a lot of people have kind of lashed back against the fact that all labels want is for you to have a 15-second TikTok hit and all that, and it's not about this and that. And I believe that all of these things, like the same with MySpace, all of these things work if you happen to enjoy them. But if you try and force it, it's almost impossible. And that's what I see with your clips and content. It's like, this feels perfect for you, because it's a medium that you're really good at expressing your thoughts and ideas in, and distilling the ideas of the cliches of different. So the drum guy, and just also the guitar drum guy, and the drum pad guy, and all these different cliches of social media. It feels perfect for you. So do you enjoy it? And is it, or do you have to go? Is there an element of you that has to go, I need a new one?
The thing is, you know, it isn't like making an album where people go, oh, that was really good. It's like you have to churn out like a new episode like every couple of days.
So you are,
and I make so many that I'm like, this is not funny enough. And you end up, you know, they don't get posted, and they sort of become like B-sides and they just sit on a hard drive somewhere. But I always loved comedy that was where you're not sure if the person's joking or not, you know? And I grew up watching, you know, like Jackass and Tom Green and Larry Sanders Show, and then like Fred Armisen, you know, he was a big hero of mine. When he was making those drum tutorial videos back in the kind of mid 2000s, when it was just a drum tutorial, but it's laced with, you're like, is it real that he's pretending that he's a paraladder doodle diddle or whatever it was called? And like, so those were really the things that I have always, that are just kind of in my soul of like, oh, okay, well, it's really funny when people aren't sure if you're joking. But then the turnaround is, you know, like you say about social media being a dumpster fire, is you don't really want to be on the receiving end of getting people angry. But when you're making like a fake loop pedal video or something, and then you really piss off all the loop peddlers and you get like hundreds of, I mean, that then it's nothing but funny.
Well, that's what I was going to say. You're kind of, you're fail-proofing yourself, because if everyone hates it, then you've nailed it. Like, I always remember I had really, like, this was maybe 2010 or 11, maybe 2011 or 12, actually. I took Brian Gittins on tour with me. I did a spoken word tour, and it was David Earl doing his Brian Gittins character. And some nights I also had Kay Tempest, and other nights I think I had Polar Bear for a few bits. And that character is genius, because again, it's an intentionally bad stand-up, but you do have people unsure. Like, if he nails it, people are unsure if this was intentional or not. And it's one of the best things to watch. I love that area of comedy as well. I fucking can't get enough of it. But David Earl, who plays Brian Gittins, is a very a sensitive soul. So I've told him before, he'd come off stage every night and apologise to me because he felt it had gone so badly. But it'd gone perfectly, because a spoken word crowd, again, that's, imagine, or it is, it's what you're doing on social media, really. It's these people who aren't sure if you're joking or not. A spoken word crowd don't know they're about to get a nuanced comedian that's pretending to be a comedian. So there were genuinely people in the crowd like, what? what's the confusion was, and I'd stand in the crowd every night just drinking it in. So I wanted to check on that with you, because you do repost a lot of them, so I've assumed that you take them well. But
oh, a lot of the insults,
you've made some people fucking furious.
It's someone messaged me, it was do you know the band Wargasm?
Yeah.
So Milky from Wargasm messaged me, and she was like, you must have, it's something like, you know, you must have nerves of steel to deal with this stuff. And I was like, nah, I just think it's funny. Like, it's a very personal thing. If you post something,
and it's kind of the goal at a point, like
to an extent, it's the goal, isn't it, as well?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure it's the same on Twitter. I think Twitter is a bit of a weird place right now. But Instagram is, the way that people find it is a lot more selective, and it caters more towards the type of people that are going to gear towards your content. But yeah, I mean, if you're making a video about tapping a guitar like a drum and saying that it's, you know, annoying, and then you get all the people that do it just coming for you, that's, I'm not saying it's the goal, but it's like, it's sort of like a ricochet effect that is like a nice bonus where you get to go, oh, yeah, okay, well, take a look at all the insults I'm getting. This is really funny, you know?
And then the people who get the joke and enjoy the joke enjoy it more because of that. So it's,
yeah,
you get extra laughs out of it. Like, you get that echo of the original joke.
Yeah, I think if with any joke, if you can get like 30% of the people to love it and 30% to not care, and then the other 30 to not be sure if it's real, that's a pretty good average, I think.
Yeah.
You know, you're never going to do something that everyone loves. But for me, that's a huge part of the joy of it, of the goal of it, is sort of, I don't know if it's negging, but yeah, like, but just making something where you go, oh, I'm not sure if, I think people might think this is real. And that's so, it's so fun to do that. And I would love to do that more in long form in a show of some kind, but that's, you know, that's further down the line, I think.
Well, speaking of shows, one of your kind of series of things that you've done is something that I've seen on social media and thought, this trend, because I talked to Alistair Green about this, that there's some stuff on social media that doesn't translate to TV, or certainly not in a polished way. If you were going to put it on TV, you'd need to, like the like Alistair Green stuff, what's great about it is how it's all made with just a phone. It's lo-fi. It's all so simple. If you then turn that into a polished sitcom, it probably wouldn't be as funny. That's kind of part, like the aesthetic is part of it. But your interviews as a music video director or as a producer just translates so perfectly. Like, and again, there was, I assume you kind of ran out of videos at one point, because there was a point where you were doing them so regularly, just pretending to explain. You'd, for example, pretend to be the director of a Bon Jovi video or whomever else.
Yeah.
And you'd break down parts of it. And again, it's just, it feels like it's endless content. It feels like you've probably filmed hours of that and turned it into it was, a 2-minute clip.
The best one was Sting. Everyone listening to this, go YouTube Sting, I'm So Happy I Can't Stop Crying. And it's one of the funniest. He's got like a mullet mohawk. He's wearing leather trousers on a horse. And then these aliens come in and do a barn dance, like CGI. And it's like, it's sort of around the time that Men in Black was a big movie. And I think that they kind of tried to jump on that bandwagon a little bit. And then there's like an anti-meat message where like the aliens cut up a CGI cow and turn it into like beef produce. And, and I was like watching it, and I was like, wow, my housemate showed it to me and went, you should, you know, and I kind of thought, oh, it's funny. Who directed that? And then you go, okay, well, it'd be funny to pretend you directed it and just make up like really spurious reasons as to why you made those choices as a filmmaker. But the reason I stopped doing it is because the copyright law changed on Instagram.
Right.
So you could no longer upload full-length music videos. So the algorithm started detecting that I was posting other people's work. So that's kind of why it stopped. And then I tried it on YouTube and the same thing happened. So
that's annoying.
That's one of those things that you have to kind of pray that in a couple of years, maybe a stream service would be like, oh yeah, we'll pay the license rights for that and you can just do it here or something like that. But with all those things, you know, every project you do, or project, fucking stupid videos, or like every script or whatever it is, comic books, whatever, even if they don't kick off and get developed, they all just sit on the shelf and you can kind of accumulate. I never really see stopping those things as a failure, because you just have them in the bank and you can always come back to them later on, you know?
Yeah. I completely agree. And again, loads of, not to try and to force work upon you, but if a BBC or a Channel 4 or whomever else, they pay PRS and licensing, so they're allowed to play music videos. So that could so easily be an iPlayer thing or a 4OD thing or whatever else that are just, endless entertainment. I need to know, were you ever a fan of the Chili Peppers?
Yeah, I love them. Yeah.
Because your Chili Peppers run killed me, but made me also go, man, I really enjoyed this at one point, and now it seems inexplicable that there was a time that I found this not only acceptable, but enjoyable. Because, yeah, you did a couple of breakdowns, I think, of just of how they write songs or...
Yeah, yeah, I did some stand-up about it. Yeah, and I posted, I did a stand-up clip, and then I think I've done three or four things now where I'm sort of laying into them. But at the same time, like, they are a brilliant... Like, Californication is a great record. And that's the thing that whenever I sort of do something that people might perceive as shitting on an artist. Like, I did one that was how to write a Bruce Springsteen song. And it was like number one, reference a dead end job, which is like working part time in a diner. And then like means of escape, which is I saved up all of my money, bought a brand new Cadillac. And then it's like name an American city because there's nothing going on in Jersey. And then then it was like, and then say things that no one can understand. And all the Springsteen fans came for me. And I've seen Bruce Springsteen live 7 or 8 times. Yeah. And it's like, I do think that... Like,
I'm a huge Springsteen fan, yeah, and I watched that and just adored it.
Like, yeah, like, obviously, all of those things come from a place of love. Like, I'm not... like, I'm getting it from 1975 fans at the minute for some silly TikTok video. And it's like, no, but, I mean, I've listened to enough of the songs to be able to break it down. And I don't listen to things that I don't like, you know? Life's too short. But you do notice traits in songwriting, and you do notice there are formulas that every musician has, and it's fun to acknowledge them. And I guess you celebrate and take the piss of maybe a little bit close together in this context. But mate, come on, like, Around the World is a banger.
Yeah, you know? 100%. But again, there's so much nonsense in all of their stuff, and it doesn't make any sense that this became a big thing.
Well, when I started doing stand-up, I used to just read out, I used to take the CD to gigs and just read out the lyrics. Before I had any jokes, I would just read out like Purple Stain or what's the one where he goes, can I swear on here?
Yeah.
What's the one where he goes, Gorilla, Cuntilla, Sammy D and Salmonella.
Come with
me because I'm an ass killer. You're ill. I'm iller. And you know, they sold 100 million records. So the joke's on me. But I mean, that is a funny lyric.
Anthony Kiedis doesn't appear in enough top 5 rappers of all time lists.
Silver, liver, 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 John Frusciante. He's great. They're great lyrics.
I love it. Have you ever watched What Makes This Song Stink?
No, I've watched What Makes This Song Great. I love Rick Beato.
You love What Makes This Song Stink. It's this comedian in America has done these as a tribute to Beato. It's on YouTube. He's only done like 5 or 6 episodes. They all got huge and then he's just not making any. It's the most annoying thing in the world. But the best one of that is when he does a Weezer song. And again, it's that beauty of... It's because he clearly loves Weezer so much that he then breaks down. And again, I think you'd really enjoy it because he's a musician. So is this, he's approaching it from a comedian and a musician's perspective, and he breaks down. Like, he'll pick a particular song that he thinks is just really bad and he'll break down why it's bad. I think you'll enjoy it. So
check it out.
There's a little plug for that. But speaking of enjoying, I fucking adored your Fringe show.
Oh, thanks, mate. You came on the worst night.
I loved it. The funniest part was I bumped into a couple of people outside that I know. I bumped into Jamie Demetriou, who had to rush off.
He didn't come to my show, did he?
No, he didn't. Annoyingly, he had to rush off. But I bumped into, I'm not going to say who, I bumped into another actor I've had on. I will, it's Nikesh Patel. I bumped into another actor and we had this really good chat. And then him and his mate said, right, we've got to go. We've got a show to get to. And they rushed off and then came back and went, what show are you queuing for? I was like, Josh Weller. I was like, yeah, that's the show we've got to get to. So it was the ultimate walk off and then walk in the same direction because we said our goodbyes and then they just came and queued with me and sat next to me for an hour.
So that's nice. I didn't know he came to the show. Oh,
yeah.
Cool.
And again, I loved it, but it felt weirdly emotional for me knowing so much of your journey. And it felt like I'd caught the show that was the culmination of the bits of your journey I know as such, if you know what I mean. Because it was, I think it was the first time I've caught you live. I might have caught you once before doing a small set, but it was definitely the first time I'd got a full set, but I'd watched loads of your clips that you share and post. Mm. And this show, I mean, it's such a fringe show, Josh. It's such a here's my life in an hour. but it works perfectly. So how was that to kind of to put together, I guess? Like when you started doing comedy, did you have in your mind, I'm going to work towards a show that is kind of addressing the fact that I'm doing comedy, addressing my music career and everything else that I wanted to do?
Yeah, I didn't want to go anywhere near music when I started doing comedy. And for the most part, I don't. Like when I do clubs, I don't take anything. I think that there's still that punk thing in me that's like, you have to be able to smash a room with a microphone. And I think mm-hmm. as soon as you're, and I'm not judging any people that use instruments or backing tracks or anything like that, because when it's great, it's brilliant. But for me, I didn't want to have a crux. I felt like I had to earn my stripes just with a microphone, and then you can kind of add to knowing you can get laughs with other aspects. But it was Alfie Brown and Claire House were both like, you need to talk about music. You need to, because I've been, you know, Alfie was, he directed the show and he was for years, like, I mean, he's a big part as to why I started doing stand-up, because I kind of, I suggested a few ideas to him that ended up in his like award-winning shows. And I remember being like, oh, for fuck's sake, like that, that could have been a great, I can't believe I said that to him. And then I started not telling him good ideas in case I could use them later on. But it wasn't ever something that I wanted to do. But then I think I was meant to go up to Edinburgh last year and I had the Pleasance, but then I got cast in The Witcher, so couldn't go. Mm-hmm. And then this year, my agent was like, yeah, you should do this. You should do that Age Against the Machine show. And I previewed it a bunch and went up and told the story of, because one of the things that really like fucks me off is that we live in this world now of like unbridled positivity and all these like CEO high performance talking to successful people and, you know, chase your dreams. And if you chase it, you'll never fail. And like, there's no like book about achieving your goals and then it not working and dealing with like abject failure. And I kind of wanted to write a show that was like the funny side of failure and why failure is actually really good for you. Because if you fail at your dream, you know, as heart-wrenching as that is, it only leads to better things. And how to deal with having a dream and not accomplishing it is a big reason that people don't try and chase their dreams, or you know, why people become embittered with failure or whatever. And I kind of just thought, oh, it'd be funny to do a show about this because I tried really hard and it didn't work. And that's funny. Rather than looking at it as a sad thing. And I wanted it to be a journey of like, I did all the things right, but it just didn't, all the beats didn't happen. All the things, all the sort of the cocktail for success just didn't mix together well enough. And I think that's a really, really good grounds for a comedy show. And I think it's really funny to talk about trying to be a pop star and like the insanity of going into co-write sessions, which is for people who don't know, is when you can't write a hit, your record label kind of, or your managers, or even just yourself, you go and write with other people who have like a track record and pop hits. And I spent years in these rooms with some of the most insane human beings on the planet, and you're almost jinxing it, because when you go in to write a hit, I would argue that every great hit, and I don't mean hit, you can write a hit with 10 people and it can be a hit, but every timeless classic, I would argue, always came from a place of honesty, not from a place of trying to write a pop hit.
Whether it's
like Teenage Dreams or, you know, like any of those great Katy Perry songs or any great Adele song, is I would argue that they all came from an honest place. And the fact that they were big hits is because people can identify with the honesty in the craft and in the songwriting and in the lyrics. And I think that I spent so long doing those sessions that was really funny. Touring is really funny. Getting a record deal in the music industry and just coked up A&Rs at your gigs and all that stuff is funny. And I realized that I'm maybe one of the few comedians that has that background that can talk about those things and kind of make jokes about them. And I started to see that as a strength or like a unique selling point or something. So, but yeah, you did come on. I think you came to the, because you text me while I was backstage.
Yeah.
And you were like, don't be shit.
Don't be shit.
Yeah. And then my dad was there, and I think Channel 4 were there, and it was just a hard room.
Mate, it was amazing.
I was so upset afterwards
to see how it like what a good one looks like, because as I said, I thought it was just fantastic, and I wish any of the people who are angry at you taking the piss out of Bruce Springsteen or whomever else needs to come and see that show, because you also break down some of your bad lyrics from your past and some of your possibly troubling, like cancelable lyrics from the past. There was one there that I was like, I hope I didn't hear that at the time, because I hoped to think I wouldn't have been like, oh yeah, that's
no,
fine.
Yeah, it was my first single. It was called Pretty Girls, and I tried to write a song about how we judge women too harshly on their looks, but I tried to write it like Randy Newman, so like in the first person, kind of make it again, like I didn't realize I was a comedian, but the lyrics were sort of meant to be funny, but in retrospect it just sounds it's just not a good song. And the funny thing was is it became like a running gag where everyone at my agency was like, oh my god, we love that song, because they were hearing it every night. So they were like, can you send us the full song? And I was like, absolutely not, no. That song dies with me.
That's not the one. It's like, no, it's the one.
Yeah, and then the co-writing lyrics.
You're not understanding the context. Yeah. I always remember me and Dan playing, is it Green Belt Festival, I think? And it's a Christian festival. And we hadn't really realised, but we were like getting a huge slot on the main stage. We're like, that's great. And I always remember the cheer that our song Let From God To Man got, or certain cheers throughout it. And that song's always gone down well, but these cheers felt different. And I felt uncomfortable because I was like, no, I don't think you're hearing this how I mean it. And it's not that it's an anti-religious song, but it certainly isn't a God is great type song. And I feel that with those A&R people probably hearing it going, yeah, man, this song's really the one. And you're like, I don't know, you get it.
Well, the same thing happened with Born to Run. It was used for the Republican presidential campaign, wasn't it? And Springsteen was like, well, I'm not playing that live anymore.
Springsteen is one of the great examples. I did a big rant about this on one of my Twitch streams recently, because people don't realise that Born in the USA is anti-America, essentially. It's talking about the lack of progression and the dead-end nature of it. Almost all of Springsteen's stuff, people think of Springsteen as the America guy. Almost all of his stuff is about how bleak it is and about people who have never moved on from high school. And just all these depressing things, yet, yeah, you see him as the America guy.
Yeah, I wonder if that ever crosses his mind when he's playing it live and he's like, okay, I don't think you're getting this.
I talked early on in this podcast, I had Wes Borland on, and we talked about that with Limp Bizkit, because Wes Borland was the ultimate kind of art school outsider kid. And then this band turned into the jock band. And he definitely had a period of being like, I don't relate to my audience at all, because I'm the art school. I'm the guy you would have all picked on at school.
Yeah.
And now you're singing along and loving it. And it's like, this feels weird and wrong. It's Al Murray.
I mean, Limp Bizkit were like a band that I didn't talk about them in the show, but there's a bit in the show where I talk about, I love when parents get offended by lyrics to songs. Mm. And it shows a generational shift, that the new generation has written a song that sums up its era so well that it offends the generation that came before it. And then I talk about the first song that offended my parents. And I ask the audience to shout out, you know, what song did you love that your parents hated? And I would say 9 times out of 10, someone in the audience shouted Limp Bizkit.
Yeah.
And I know enough about them that I would go, oh, I don't really know about Limp Bizkit. And then I'd tell this like very intricate story as to their success and how they were accepted by the black community. And then they kind of spearheaded the new metal movement. And then I remember seeing Wes Borland when he left Limp Bizkit, and he said, he was like, you know, the money's great, but this is what it feels like to sell out. He's like, this is what it feels like when your soul turns black.
Yeah.
And then he left after, after Chocolate Starfish. So he was like, yeah, that's cool. Let's call the album Chocolate Starfish and the Hot Dog Flavoured Water.
You see, that's the beautiful thing with your music love and knowledge and fandom, is you did a similar thing when someone picked an Eminem song, and you could give just, at the one I was at, and give a detailed history of Eminem's rise, every album and all of that kind of thing. And it's great to have that kind of up your sleeve as such.
it's just like a silly party trick. And I remember someone afterwards said that it was one night someone was like, oh, was that a plant? Like, did you put someone in the audience to shout that out? And I was like, do you really think I have the budget to pay someone to come to my show every night and sit there and shout out Len?
Yeah. Yes.
Or Smash Mouth.
Like. One day you will. One day you will.
Fingers crossed.
We're getting towards having to wrap this up, but I want to talk a little bit about, because you touched upon your show being about kind of achieving your dreams and failing as such, or reaching those goals and failing. And I wonder, is the music industry one of the only industries that's, I think it's 90% set up to believe that you've failed. And again, to go back to when we were gigging, people like Kate Nash and Paloma and numerous others sign into big labels and doing absolutely amazing, but at different points always being made, no matter how high they were, you're made to feel as if you're failing. I remember gigging with Paloma at her first album launch, I think, and it being one of the best gigs I've ever seen, and going backstage and some record label exec had the keyboardist, I think it was, in tears because they'd started a song in the wrong key and they'd had to perform this song in the wrong key and all this. And I'm like, I'm there at my level going, this is the dream. They've headlined the Hoxton Bar and Kitchen. You know, and at that point, I'm like, wow, how could you get to these heights? But I think it is an industry for that, right? Because I'd say, again, so much of what you did, you did get signed to a major label, admittedly the French leg of a major label, but
still counts.
You had all these things happen, but success is never really success unless you become Adele or Bruce Springsteen or whomever else. I think, again, I remember Kate Nash getting dropped from the label because that next album, I think, only had 2 top 10 hits or some shit like that. And it's like, what? And that's failure.
I was listening to an interview with a punk band I like a lot recently, and from the 90s, and they were saying that the week that their second album came out, the label were really disappointed because it only sold 240,000 copies. And I was like, that's the biggest album of the year now.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was just nothing back then.
And you're a punk band.
Yeah, exactly.
You're not meant to sell any.
It's a weird one. I think, because I don't really have a dog in the fight at all. I don't have a dog in the fight anymore. Like, I'm not a musician. I'm not engaged with the music industry or anything like that. But it's interesting that so many people ask me about it. And I do feel like I feel very passionate about the welfare of musicians. Like, it's so hard to make it nowadays.
Well, I know in 2018, we spent a lot of that episode talking about Spotify and how hard it can be because of the revenues and all that. And that hasn't got any better.
I mean, no, it's, if anything, it's gotten worse. And you know, it's so much harder for bands to profit on merch now as well, because, you know, I don't know enough about this to really talk about it, but my assumption is that Brexit has upped production costs and shipping costs. Mm-hmm. So like, if you buy it of, like, I went to see, so my old bass player from my punk band, I was in a punk band called The Kenneths. So he's now in a band called Dry Cleaning, who are smashing it. And he was saying that, I went to the gig and he was like, oh, don't buy the vinyl because we don't make any profit on it. And I remember being really confused because I was like, oh, I thought that was like the main thing that you
vinyl
sold.
Vinyl was the big thing to sell because it really,
And the avenues, it's like the music industry, see, it feels to me like, you know that, I always forget the name of the artist, but you know that drawing of those ladders that just go, the staircase, sorry, that just goes round and round and round?
MC Escher.
Yeah.
The greatest MC.
Yeah, or like
up there with Anthony Kiedis.
He was here. I always feel like it's like a house where every door has a brick wall behind it now for musicians. Yeah. I'm like, what are the things that you can do? Because if you're playing live, like, fuck, man, like, we got like 50 quid a show, and we played the Royal Albert Hall, and we got like 150 quid to open for someone at the Royal, to open for Leanne Le Havas at the Royal Albert Hall. And the gig probably cost us a grand to do. So you're in the hole and just from one show by a lot of money. And now I really want to, you know, I there has to be a way for musicians to start seeing profit from, you know, and especially now when you can find a fan base, you know, I walk past posters all the time and I'm like, who the fuck has sold out the Roundhouse? I don't even know who the band is. Which is also just age. Like, I'm not, you know, that's just why pop music's not for me anymore.
And I think leaving the music industry, because I had a weird thing of after I stopped making music, I listen to so little new music, at least now. And again, I can't decide if it's related to music or, as you just say, age. That's what happens. But yeah, but it, I mean, it's interesting because I was talking to a publisher friend of mine recently, and I want to mention this on the podcast now in case there is anyone listening, but if I had loads of money, I would open either a vinyl pressing factory in the UK or a publishing, like a book printing factory in the UK, because there's like two of each and the demand is through the roof. As you say, because of Brexit, all the ones in Germany and Holland that people used to use just aren't affordable anymore. And it just feels like an absolute open goal from a business point of view, but also would be really positive for art, because it would be positive for small run publishers in the UK, for small record labels in the UK, for small bands in the UK, all of these things. So yeah, if anyone is listening, start up a fucking
if there are any entrepreneurial billionaires listening to this podcast, start.
You make the money. I don't want to cut. I just want to see, because as you say, and t-shirts as well, you're completely right. And part of that is Brexit, but part of that is positive, because it's people going, oh, maybe we shouldn't be using unethical means to get these t-shirts made. So that ramps the price up. But it does also mean if you're not comfortable charging 40 quid for a t-shirt, then you're going to struggle to make a profit on it. And that was always the thing. People would always argue, I've downloaded your music for free, but I'm coming to the gig and I'm buying the t-shirt. And my argument would always be, would you say to a plumber, I'm not going to pay you for doing the bathroom, but I've paid for the kitchen and I've paid for the radiators. It's like, no, they're separate things that have their own costs attached to them. And as you say, gigs cost money and aren't always a massive money spinner. They can be, but aren't always a massive money spinner. So, and the same with like merch. It's like, you know, I didn't get that merch for free, right? Like, you're buying my merch to make up for the album I spent thousands on making as well and have to live off. But the merch cost thousands as well.
We did when the punk band did the Warped Tour in 2016, around then. And we'd have these merch drop-off points. So that tour, if you don't know it, so it's like it's sort of like the crowning achievement of punk tours.
Mate, so I know I texted you about it at the time, but you and Brett Goldstein, who I mentioned earlier, I've always been someone, luckily, particularly in these industries, who doesn't get jealous of my mates. I'm always excited for their achievements. You and Brett are the two only times I've had a moment of being, oh, fuck you. I've then got on to being happy and proud. It was when Brett got a Marvel role, because I'm a massive superhero nerd, and I had a moment of, ah, for fuck's sake. But then got really excited. And it was when you got the Warped Tour, because the Warped Tour was my mecca from when I was a little punk kid. That was the dream. And when you got the Warped Tour, I had a moment of, fuck Josh and fuck the Kenniffs. And then I got over it and text you like, dude, this is amazing.
That makes Have a great so time. What's Brett Goldstein's Marvel role?
He's Hercules. So he's only had the post-credit sequence in one of the Thor films, but it's the big post-credit sequence. He comes up and he's like, I will get him, Father. So he's going to come after Thor.
So he's going to be... So they're going to make the character bigger.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Assumedly. Again, all these things change all the time, but that's just presumably the plan.
For the people listening who don't know what that means, it means that Brett Goldstein is not going to eat a carb for the next 7 years.
Yeah.
That's what that means.
Yeah, it's insane. I remember hearing it. I saw a chat with him about it and he was like, I got it. And I proceeded to do like 500 prep, because he was filming Ted Lasso at the time. He proceeded to do like 500 press ups every day in the lead up to it, because it's a tiny little scene. But yeah,
we had merch drop offs every night on that tour, so we would have to. I mean, you'd be in like the ball bag of America, and they'd drop off five boxes of t-shirts, and then you'd sit in your tent after your show every day and try and sell. I think we sold like $11,000 worth of merch on that tour. And it was like, that was genuinely how we paid for our US visas. It was how we paid for our flights. It was the only way that we could do that tour. Because I think on the Warped Tour, we got $450 a day, which between three people is not a lot of money. And then you pay immediately, you know, your bus cost is $150 a day. So immediately that's down to $300. And we weren't really taking any of that. I think we were taking like $30 a day per diem, which is like just for food and drink and stuff. And yeah. And I was talking to a music manager recently whose artist is opening for, I can't remember who it was, but someone big on tour, sort of 5,000 cap venues a night. And he said, oh yeah, we're not even bothering with merch because it's also not just production costs. It's also the lack of income that people have now is they're not spending money on merch for the support bands. They're only buying merch for the headliners. So that's a whole other like market lost. It's like, yeah, man, it's upsetting.
It really is. And it's so, yeah, it's hard to know what the solution is. But as said, we were shouting about this in 2018 and it was already an old subject that the music industry just, it's so hard to make money now because of, and again, the fact it's every revenue is going away. You're just not going to have musicians. Like, you're going to have far fewer musicians because people just can't afford to do it. Or it'll all be a little rich kids.
Yeah.
So shout out to the 1975.
Yeah. In 2028, maybe when I come back, we'll be able to talk about it differently.
It'll be a solution. Hey, the music industry turned out fine, didn't it?
Hey, it was all, look at this, we're all happy.
Who knew? Well, to wrap things up, what's ahead? Or I've got a note here, and this seems like such a trite question, but are you happier, Josh, like in comedy than you were in music? Because again, you seem just so, it seems so, and again, this is as someone who was a big fan of you as music. I booked you. I can prove I was a fan of you in music, but you seem so at home in this world. And I just want to know kind of, are you happier as such?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, there's a long way to go. I've got a lot that I still want to accomplish. And I still see myself as, like, I did a gig the other night and there was two like new comics and they were asking me for advice. And I was like, I'm still the student, you know, like I'm not in any
it's
way.
It's mad, isn't it? Because you started just before COVID.
Yeah.
So the length of your time in comedy is deceptive.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
yeah,
I've so you've been doing it for 4 years, but have you?
No, exactly. Like, I there was a year, you can take a year out of that and change now, immediately. Yeah. And I said to the guys, I was like, you do realize if I give you advice, I'm going to go on stage and just eat my balls and bomb, which is exactly what happened. It completely jinxed the gig.
But
I am, definitely. I mean, I love doing this. It's the best thing. I mean, to get a second like lease of life when you've failed at something and to be better at it and to be naturally better at it and to look forward to it every night. You know, I'm enjoying it so much just going into clubs at the minute and just trying to write new material and then maybe I'll tour the Age Against the Machine show next year. I know that we're looking at dates for it at the minute, but I'm unsure whether I want to do that. We might just do some London shows. But I get to make dick jokes professionally. Like what? How many people get to stand on a stage and talk about farts and get paid? It's such a gift. And then the acting thing has like opened up this whole other door of fun. And the acting I really just see is if I never act again, it's not the end of the world. It's like the icing on the cake of a very tasty sponge. But yeah, I mean, I love it. I'm very happy. But again, like, you know, I still feel like I'm very much at the beginning of this journey for sure.
But that's what's exciting, right? I've told this story many a time, but moving into acting and script writing for me was the weirdest thing because it's the first industry I've ever been in where I'm genuinely excited about the future.
Mm.
And with music, like with the Kenniffs as an example, you were really energetic and really on it. And, you know, my example is always, I loved everything I did as a rapper, but I didn't like the idea of being a 50-year-old rapper or a 60-year-old rapper or so on and so forth. And similar with the Kenniffs, it's like, it's not the kind of, obviously you've got your NoFX and your Rancid and people like that who can maintain this. But in general, it's like, it's not the nicest idea of being old in that world. Whereas comedy, you're just going to get better and better and better at acting. You're just going to get better and better and better. And
yeah, and every negative in music has become a positive in comedy as well. Like age, maybe race on some level. You know, my knees, like, it's like, it doesn't matter if my, I had knee surgery a couple of months ago because I tried to be in a punk band or I was in a punk band. And every sort of, every negative has become a really, really good thing in comedy. And it's a weird one as well. Like punk was jazz and blues musicians, that music ages like a fine wine. Like, you know, like the older you get as a blues musician, the sadder your soul gets and the better your music chops get. And you become better and better at it. But punk music is like bread. Like it needs to be eaten while it's fresh, you know?
And it's fucking perfect.
But then there are, I'm a huge Descendants fan, and like I saw them last year and they were incredible still. Mm. And they're all in their 50s or mid 50s now. And so there are bands that are exceptions to that rule. But I always wanted to be a really good musician. I never had that hand-eye coordination where I could or the ear where I could just pick up a guitar and just wail on it. And I think when I do stand-up and you're on stage and you have a joke and you riff something and something comes out and you go, oh my God, okay, I've broken into a new area with this joke. I can, that's going in the set and I can now flesh this out. That's like the closest I can get to being a great musician. Yeah. It's like when you kind of come up with something spontaneous and you go, oh shit, that was really funny.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I couldn't be touring in a punk band now. I watched a couple of old videos from researching the Age Against the Machine show, and I was stage diving every night. I was like, mm-hmm. I mean, I've still got a chip in my tooth from, I jumped into the crowd and my mic broke my tooth.
My ribs are wonky from too much stage diving, from too much throwing myself into the crowd. As a 6'4" guy, it's like you're doing yourself damage, but I couldn't resist every night. But, well, to wrap things up, speaking of age and race, how was it doing your Age Against the Machine show, doing a show about being, you know, old, experienced, lived your life, a failure, and looking like you're in your early 20s?
Mm.
How was that? You look too young,
good, isn't it?
You look too young to do the haggard I've lived a life type show. It's just infuriating.
It's a disconnect, isn't it? My advice: if you take anything away, like the Baz Luhrmann sunscreen song, if you take anything away from this podcast, the thing to take away is cocoa butter. That is the greatest. It's not trying to be successful as a comic or trying to make it as a musician or a difficult industry. Every day, twice a day, just slather your face in the oiliest body, not face moisturizer. Just when I was 9 years old, I went to school and my mum went, oh, and I was all ashy. And my mum went, she was like, you need to, you know, black people have to moisturize our skin. And that is the greatest gift that ever. And probably not doing manual labor as well. That's probably a big part of it as well.
That's a good tip. Bill Burr's got a good joke about it. And
holy shit, I'm ashy. Yeah.
But when he talks about, and again, he's like, people talk about black don't crack and how black people don't age and it's a genetic thing. It's like, he's like, every black person I've ever met moisturizes.
Yeah, yeah.
Every
yeah.
white guy I've ever met does not moisturize. It's not some magic thing.
But it's a
you're
weird
going out
thing.
And sitting in the sun and letting yourself burn and then just getting all dried out. It's like, just fucking moisturize and look after your skin.
Yeah, I've had people come up to me after shows and be like, what's, you know, like, you do look young. And I've like with white people who've asked me, whenever I say, oh, just moisturize twice a day, that's all you have to do. It's like I've told them to try and zip wire off a mountain, that this look comes off their face. They're like, oh, yeah. I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
That's not a heavy
lift. Is there
lift.
Another option?
Yeah.
Is there another answer? Is there a pill I can take? It's so simple. I love it.
But yeah, that was a problem because I do. And it's something I'm very lucky to have. I look very young for my age. But then equally, you can play into that on stage as well. So there are ways to sort of, to make that funny as well. But
of course.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Thank you, Palmer's Cocoa Butter, for the eternal youth.
I love it. Well, thank you very much, man. It's been a pleasure as ever. And we need to actually catch up in the flesh at some point. I know I'm saying
that.
Yeah,
we say this every time we see each other.
You came out of your show and said, do you fancy getting a drink? And I was like, no, I'm off. Bye.
Yeah.
So I know that this is me saying that and then going, oh, actually.
I'll see you at a tube station twice a year. And then we're both, one of us is in a massive hurry. It's normally you.
I've said to a few people, I think it's what I love about The Fringe, because like, you are someone I'd enjoy actually hanging out with for an extended period, but I'm not really into extended period hangouts. And at The Fringe, everyone's in a rush. So it's my dream, because I love seeing everyone, but I don't want to spend a whole evening with everyone. So the amount of people at The Fringe I bump into, and then either I or them get to say, I've got to go, I've got a show. So we have a 15-minute catch-up, and then I don't have to go through the rigmarole of actually socialising.
Oh, it's the best, the dream, isn't it? As you get older,
it's fucking amazing.
Like, I celebrate plans getting cancelled, like I've scored a goal in a football game.
Mate,
like, it's the best thing in the world when someone's like, oh, that thing's... I had a thing cancelled last night. I was meant to go to a show, and the guy texted me and was like, I'm not very well. And I was like, fuck, it's the dream. So good.
I've been telling this story for over 5 years, and it explains, you know, how big a deal this is. But I was at the train station up the road from me at Stamford train station, and a guy I used to DJ with, Bill, came onto the station. I'm heading into London, and he said, oh, all right, but how you doing? And we had a chat, and then he said, all right, I'm going to go up the other end of the train now. Good to see you. And it was just beautiful. I was like, yes, this is it. We don't need to sit together for a full hour on the train into London now. We just had that moment, and both of us as grown-ups who want to put our headphones back on and listen to stuff just went, okay, bye. And he initiated that. And I already loved him, but I've loved him all the more since, because I
worked behind the till in a toy shop for 4 years on Westbourne Grove. Mm. And a couple of months ago, I was standing outside a tube station, and a woman walked out who I used to work behind the till with. She did the kids' parties or something like that. Mm. And she went, oh, Josh, how you doing? And I went, yeah, really good. How are you? And she went, yeah, good. She went, how have the last few years been? And I went, yeah, really good. What about you? She was like, yeah, good. Got married, had a kid. And I went, oh, that's amazing. And then she went, well, that's as well as we know each other. See you later. It was fantastic.
I love it. When I worked in HMV, one of my mates, who's now one of my best mates, we really hit it off when we first met, but he was above me. He called me into the office one day and said, right, I think we've kind of run out of things to say to each other for the time being. So let's not talk much for, like, shall we say 2 weeks? And then we'll get back to it. And we just didn't say anything to each other for 2 weeks. Then came back, had loads to catch up on. But because we were seeing each other every day, it was like, this has been amazing. I don't want it to burn out. I don't want to ruin it. Let's put a pause on our friendship. And it was fucking ideal. I love that people can be grown up about these things.
Well, Pip, coming on your show has been amazing, and I don't want it to burn out.
I'll see you in a few years.
That's as much as we know each other. That's fine.
See, what we need to do, I'm now extended this, or what we need to do is you, me, and Stu Whiffin go out at some point, because you boys fell really deeply in love for like a brief period of time.
No, it's still there. It's still there. I love that.
Perfect. He's so
good. Oh my
good.
God.
Yeah. I love him dearly. Well, we'll organise something at some point soon. We won't.
Yeah,
but yeah, we'll try to.
That was, we do need to tie this up, but I used to love walking past, because when I started doing stand-up, you were still doing your We Are Lizards night.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would walk past the big queue on my way home every Friday, because I'd do a show and I'd come back. Yeah. And then I got to come into the venue, have a beer with you wearing a fucking lizard mask, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know if you've ever tried to catch up with someone who has a prosthetic mask on their face, who's also playing like a Big Poppa dance remix. But like, it's very hard to have an act. So I would drink like whatever like beer was behind your thing. And then I'd go, all right, see you next week. And that was how we caught up for quite a while.
It's perfect. It's perfect.
Yeah, yeah,
I fucking love it. Well, I need to start the club night up again, and then we can get back into our process.
Perfect.
Well, it's been a pleasure, mate. And I'm excited for all that is ahead. As said, I genuinely watch your stuff, and it feels so perfectly you. And I love that people are getting to see you. Like, again, not to keep mentioning Brett Goldstein, but there's a comparison there as well. I've known Brett for years, and it's been so good seeing the rest of the world finally get to see Brett. And it feels like that with your posts on socials and your stand-up. It's like, yeah, this is how everyone was meant to see Josh. So yeah, it's a beautiful thing to see, man.
Well, I look forward to getting cast as a supporting role in a major Apple TV show, winning an Emmy, and then getting in a Marvel movie. So fingers crossed.
I can't wait. Yeah. I'll talk soon, mate.
See you, mate.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Josh Weller. I hope you enjoyed that. I recommend following him on all socials, Instagram, just so many good videos, and he's angering people on TikTok daily. As I said, the web store is going to be closed for Black Friday over the whole weekend, I reckon, but I encourage you to donate to shelter. You can do so at speechdevelopmentrecords.com, or you can come along to my charity bike ride at twitch.tv/ScroobiusPipio around 5 p.m. on Friday, and you can donate there and just have general interaction along the way. I'll be back next week with more good. Until then, stay safe and stay sane. I'd like to apologise for saying good then. It felt right in the time. As soon as it came out of my mouth, I felt dirty. And not the good kind of dirty. So apologies to everyone about that. But I'll see you next week, I guess. Until then, stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.